As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
This is The Athletic Football Show.
Welcome, everybody, to Season 2, Episode 34 of the Football GM Podcast right here on the Athletic Football Show every Saturday, not only during the NFL season, but during the real fun NFL season, which is the offseason where we're at right now, a couple weeks before the draft. I am Mike Sando, Senior Writer for The Athletic, along with the General Manager. Good morning, Mr. Randy Mueller.
Michael, how you doing, buddy?
I'm doing well. I guess it's afternoon, whatever. It doesn't matter. The team guys probably have no idea. They've been in a dark room probably for the last week or two. What? Before we get into, we're gonna rank Randy's running backs and tight ends in the draft today. We're going to hit some other news and notes around the league, including the latest on the lawsuit with Brian Flores and the situation with the audio that came out of Mike Mularkey through the Titans process. We'll get to that. But Randy, you've been in the, 35 years in the league. So this time of year, a couple weeks before the draft, what's everybody been doing? I know we got pro days. We got what happens?
Yeah, I think right now the pro days are starting to wind down a little bit. There are some teams that haven't got all the input of the pro days and really of their coaching staff either quite yet. I think you've got to guard a little bit now against having too much time on your hands, because you don't want to have a bunch of cards all of a sudden start moving rows and moving around on your draft board. That was always something that I was deathly against. We're not going to start moving people around all over the place now because one opinion got changed or one coach saw this. But you have to guard against that, because sometimes the loudest voice in the room thinks they're right all the time. And that comes up probably between now and the draft more than any other time, because everybody's in a little bit of a panic, right? They like their guys. They want to get their guys up. And I used to work for a group that one of their instructive values was it, and you tell me if you agree with this, Mike. I'm trying to get the verbiage right. They said, you, it's your fault if you don't get your guys drafted.
Wow.
And that never made sense to me. It actually made the hair stand up on the back of my head, because it's never about your scout or your area or anybody getting their guys drafted. That's the epitome of the opposite of what I wanted to do. And that used to fry me when I would hear that. I want to get it right. And usually the truth is in the middle. So I want to build consensus and hear everybody's point of view. I don't want a particular scout in an area that speaks the loudest to all of a sudden get all his guys drafted. That's not
he
it
He wants
at
all the Western Region guys to get going. Yeah. You're like, no, what if the guy from Southwest Texas State is better? We want him, right?
That's exactly right. And that should be our goal. But it just goes to show how many different philosophies are at work around the league. Everybody sees the drafting process slightly different. And sometimes the differences are extreme. And that used to frustrate the heck out of me sometimes, because I'm always about the team and all of us being heard, not the carnival barkers or the salesman. You know, that's not part of it at all.
I got a couple ones for you on that. So we always hear, hey, this guy's climbing up draft boards, right? Translation, Mueller, what does that mean?
Total BS. I mean, there's no way. If they are, they're doing an injustice to their draft process and the whole last 12 months. If you let something like this happen, and we'll talk about a couple of these things, because I know for a fact there are players, I've seen it, but I know from this year in particular, some players that were graded high by teams now have gone to a pro day that maybe was attended by a scout or a coach, it really doesn't matter, and didn't do well at his pro day. They didn't go to the combine, or he went to the combine and didn't run. And then all of a sudden he runs at his pro day because he's a little healthier. But now we're going to ding this guy for everything he does at a pro day in shorts and t-shirts running around. That stuff used to drive me crazy as well. So you have all kinds of philosophies. If I really like a guy on tape and I have zero questions about him, I hope he goes and runs bad at his pro day. Because then everybody that's weak will not pick him, and they'll drop him down in their process. So there's just a lot of different mindsets, a lot of different philosophies, a lot of different confidence levels, so to speak. And that's part of, leading, but it's different for every team.
So what if you need – let's just say your team needed a quarterback this year. Doesn't that – in fact, I was talking to a coach about this, that idea then – do people then like bend what they think about the prospects to make it more palatable to draft a guy where you're at? Do you think that happens to where, hey, we're picking 14th, we need a quarterback. There's probably not one that we would grade that high, but by the end of the thing, dang it, he was the highest guy on our board. Does that happen?
100%. It happens all the time. It really happens sometimes with, I talked a little bit about what you got to guard against with scouts, but you have to guard against it with coaches too, because coaches want their guys. They want you to spend a second round pick on a tight end because that's their position. View of the world. You know, it's totally different. So you've got to watch. You've got to, again, evaluate the evaluators and take a step back from 30,000 feet. And that's why I said, and you asked me, I think when we initially said the difference between evaluators and team builders, there is a big difference, because the team builder has that look from 30,000 feet. The evaluators, and you see it all the time in especially in the media world, where an evaluator looks at a specific player and just puts him where he thinks his value is off the chart. But that may not be valuable to the total team build. We may not draft him in a spot that makes sense, but that's okay. You've got to realize that we have a bigger cause than making your sequence list correct. If that makes any sense.
You don't have to say where you're at or disclose if you don't want to. But so what's an example of a player that suddenly you showed up on draft day and the guy was way higher than you thought? Or if you remember anything like that with a specific player?
Well, I don't know about specifics, but there was a time I spent with one organization where we as scouts or not the boss, let me just say that, we would laugh when we come in the morning and the cards had been moved around. And we used to have a little saying, we'd say, well, I guess we had another all-star game last night, huh? Yeah. Because there's no more film to watch. We've already evaluated everybody. So the scouts would laugh at each other and say, yeah, see, we had another Senior Bowl last night or another blue-gray game or something like that. So the cards got moved around. And that just shows that, hey, we all notice. But there might be a valid reason for it too. So you've got to kind of take a step back as you see things through a worm's eye and understand that the decision makers see it through the bird's eye.
Yep, absolutely. Well, let's launch into our continuing series. Last week, we talked about the wide receivers and why you liked certain ones. I think Chris Olave was number one. You had the two Ohio State guys up there. People can check that out, obviously, on last week's podcast. We're going to do running backs and tight ends today. And I've got the list here of who you've got. But let's just start with running backs, Randy. I'll leave the floor to you. What do you value in the position? And, you know, we hear a lot about running backs, frankly. Right. I mean, should you take one early? You know, no, you should never pay one. Those are all things I guess we could get into if we wanted to. But for you, what's a great back?
Yeah, I think you have to start with the criteria and what you're looking for. And I agree with those points that you've made come from different parts of your building, especially, you know, cap guys or other people that chime in to say, hey, we can't ever give a running back that much value because we're not going to be able to afford him on a second contract and things like that. But my thinking is when you set the criteria for running back, you're looking for two things. You're either looking for a guy who can do everything and play on third downs and have explosive athleticism to allow you to score from anywhere, or you're looking for a skill set specifically that you get from another player that you fit in to the skills that you don't have on your team. So in other words, a spot player, or a full-time player. That's the big delineation you have to make. And I think if you can divide them up into different buckets to start with, you have a chance to really line them up in a valued way, which makes some sense to everybody.
And I would think for our purposes here, we're talking about the do-it-all guy, because we're going to rank running backs. We're talking about somebody you would actually take earlier, right? You wouldn't take a spot back necessarily. If you're going to rank your top five running backs, there wouldn't ever be a spot back in there, would there?
No, there wouldn't, but there might only be one or two three-down backs. So gotcha. In a particular draft, and I think in this particular draft here, we start to fill specific needs after about three guys. So yeah. It just happens to be that's the way it works. You're not going to find it. Here's the guys I've drafted. Amon Green, third down back, first, second, and third down back, could do it all. Deuce McAllister, first, second, third down back. You know, those are guys that, you know, can carry the mail. They can play on passing downs. They can pass block. That's the criteria you look for if you're going to draft one in the first round. There was one last year, Najee Harris, right, with the Steelers. Yeah. He was only back. And some thought maybe he wasn't quite the third down back as was needed to be valued there. But I think he turned out to be pretty good in all three downs and in both phases of the game. So for my money, the best one I saw this year for what I've seen, and I'm going to stress this, I'm not a scout, so I'm not unearthing guys at Western Colorado State like Kyle Eckler. I'm not. I'm just looking at the consensus from some of the people around the league to come up with six or seven names and then put them in order.
So gotcha. That's, so you looked at kind of the mainstream backs.
Yes.
You know, How many backs did you end up probably looking at?
Oh, I think there's six or seven. You know, maybe there's eight or nine, but there's the bottom of that list. I don't consider. Yeah. I would consider these guys all in the first three rounds at some point. That's my opinion.
Right, but to get this list, did you have to look at 20 or did you have to look at 10?
Oh, I probably looked at 15. Probably twice as many to narrow it down to this. Yeah.
So I'm very go ahead and unveil your number one guy.
Well, for my money, and it's funny because we went through receivers last week, and there was two at the same school, right? Two Ohio State guys. Yeah. There's two running backs at Georgia this week that ended up being the two highest guys for me, both rotational guys because of how good they are and the skill set that they have. The kid that I came out on top with the guys I looked at was Zamir White from Georgia. He's just under 6 foot tall. He's 215 pounds. He runs 4.4. But here's the issue, and I'll talk about some of the specifics. He's going to have two ACL surgeries before he ever takes a snap in the NFL. So that's another thing that when we as outsiders look at tape and evaluate on film, we don't have the medical information. We don't have the character information that NFL teams do. So to get hot and bothered because they don't see him exactly like we do is a waste of oxygen because they have more information than us. Plus, there's 8 or 10 opinions in every scout's room, every team's room, so they can build a consensus. These evaluations that we're talking about are really a one-man show. It's just what I see on tape, which would be about, you know, a fifth of the information in a normal draft room.
Now, that being said, you do know that he's had these ACLs, but we've seen, Frank Gore had a couple. Yep. And
I'm not Frank disregarding. Gore. No, I'm just saying you're going to have to check some boxes before you're okay with this.
And what I noticed is, Randy, because I love to just compare how people see him. So I went through other, you know, just kind of the media general managers who are doing these things, you know, whether it was Mel Kiper or Dane Brugler at The Athletic or whatever. I don't see Zamir White in the top five for him. So I love that. So let's talk a little bit more then about him and why him and who do you compare him to?
I think the thing for me is I want to find, and this is in the criteria of what I'm looking for, I want to find a guy that gives me the feeling when he gets the ball in his hands that we might score. And that's a hard one to define on paper. I found it with Amon Green. I thought we had it with Deuce McAllister. Those kind of guys, when they get the ball, you kind of get a little skip in your breath, you know, where you say, oops, he might go. He might not, but he might. And so I felt like that when I watched Zamir White. You never know watching tape that this guy had two ACLs. He runs hard inside. He's got juice through the hole. Outside, he has speed to turn the corner. He just plays really fast and has a little top-end gear shift once he gets in the secondary. He can run away from tacklers. But the thing I really loved about him is his pad level in traffic. He has balance. He breaks arm tackles. He sets up arm tackles on instincts and vision. And he makes people miss, both in line and in space. He's just a really hard guy for a single tackler to get on the ground. But the other thing that kind of set him apart for me is a really good route runner. He can create separation, puts his foot in the ground. You know, he can run an angle route, which linebackers are always struggling to cover. But he finds it with the body control of kind of a receiver in that he can set him up to gain this separation. And he's a willing and capable pass blocker as well. So every year, you know, you don't always find the guys that can contribute on passing downs, on running downs, yep. You know, blocking, catching. I thought his hands were excellent. He just gave me that feeling that he might be able to score a touchdown every time he got the ball. So I had him at the top.
Yep. And you had James Cook next, his teammate, ahead of Iowa State Breece Hall, who may be one or two on a lot of the other lists that I've seen. Yeah. So why Cook ahead of him, and why Cook not quite as high as his teammate?
I think Cook, for me, and it's a different style, and that's probably why Kirby Smart at Georgia played both these guys and rotated them. They're different styles. Cook, for me, is a more upright runner, and he was the senior there. So, I mean, we've all been around programs where seniors get rewarded for being there and playing, you know, and so this guy probably played a lot because he had been there and paid his dues, but a totally different style. This guy's a kind of a one-cut slasher. He runs a little bit upright, not really powerful behind his pads like White was, but he's very nifty-footed, and he has a north-south acceleration to him that kind of reminded me a little bit of Deuce McAllister, a little bit of an upright runner, like I said, but that's going to cost him run. He's not a downhill guy between the tackles. So the best thing that James Cook did for me was he, in the passing game, he caught the ball and made people miss. He can get upfield. He ran away from defenders after he has the ball in his hands. So I like the way he catches the ball. He's got soft hands. He can catch balls that aren't specifically on target. So I thought there's a chance that this kid could be an every down back. He carried the ball a lot and has a lot of production in both the passing game and the running game. So he runs 4.45. I didn't think he was the style that I maybe seek, but I think someone will see him a little bit like they saw Najee Harris in Pittsburgh last year. So Breece Hall was my third guy. And this was fascinating for me. So I looked at the tape before I looked up anything else on Breece Hall, did any investigating or anything. So I saw a guy who has run a lot, has been run a lot. They ride him.
Yep.
He's an
yep.
every down back at Iowa State. He's a downhill workhorse volume type carrier. But the one thing he's not, from my money, he's not explosive on the field. He's a traditional body lean pad level guy that breaks some arm tackles, but he kind of picks and slides with some natural vision. He just doesn't run away from anybody or make you say, wow, he's going to go. He's not like that. He's going to grind it out. And then I went back after I looked at the tape and looked at the numbers that he tested. He tested to a 40 time of 4.38. He had a 40 inch vertical jump. These are explosive numbers, right?
Yeah.
But I just never saw that equate on film. So that's a hard one for scouts. It's a hard one for evaluators. I always err on the side of what I saw on film. So I'm going to take that over a workout, or I'm going to take that over these numbers that we all run around the spring and try to collect. So I just didn't see that same explosive timed workout stuff when I saw him on tape. Now, he had 36 catches. He ran the ball 253 times. I mean, this guy's, he's used in every single way at Iowa State, but I just saw him more as a grinder who lacked any big play ability. And I was worried about him bringing anything to the table other than just being a ball carrier, you know? So nothing really jumped out at me about this kid.
Yes. So, and let's just, as we reset this, and we have Zamir White, we have James Cook, we have Breece Hall. In your mind, and again, just off the film you've watched, not the full investigation you would do if you were an organization, but do you have a feel for, you know, how you would grade them, or what round, or is there any sort of a reference point we could put on these guys to say how much you like them in the context of an entire draft, not just in the context of each other?
Yeah, I think it's a comfort level for me, and I can't speak for other teams. I can only state my comfort zone where I would feel comfortable with him. And I don't think I could feel comfortable taking Brees in the first round. There's just not enough juice there. There's not enough big playability there. So I think he's probably, for me, more of a second or third round type back. I'd have no problem with the first kid from Georgia, Zamir White, because I see the speed. I see the explosiveness. I see a three down back. And some of the skill sets that I'm describing obviously determine the value of when you would take a guy. You started the conversation by saying we're not going to take spot players probably through the first three rounds.
Right.
So I think all three of these guys are more than spot players, so I would consider them in the first three rounds for sure, and in the order that I've mentioned. The other thing you got to set up is the schemes that they're going into, the criteria and the scheme-specific fits of certain backs are going to make them more valuable to some teams than others.
Yep. Now, you have Brian Robinson, number four on your list, and I don't see him in the top fives of some of these other ones in media. So why do you like him? And how much do you really like him?
Well, I like him, but here's the point. I have a fourth round grade on him. So that's okay. How quick the backs disappeared for me.
Gotcha.
And they disappear because they're one trick ponies, or they're undersized, or they don't play with any speed and explosion. So there's just not that many guys, but I think that's every year the error of, and it's not really an error, the difference is in media projections and NFL inside building projections are there's a lot less players in NFL eyes than there are in, and I'll use Mel for an example, or Todd, or any of these other guys. There's not that many players. So they tend to err on the side of there's, you know, might be 10 running backs this year. Well, really, in the NFL setup, there might be four on any given year, if that makes any sense.
Right. Yeah. So you had Robinson next.
I thought he's similar to Cook. He's just a little slower afoot. He's a bit of a slasher. I worry a little bit about these slashers when I say they can make one cut and then hit the hole. And if they run upright, I worry about their durability because that's a big target. They've given their exposure to their chest and their hip area to defenders to really knock them back. So I worry about their durability because they're going to take some hits because they're not running behind their pads. And Brian Robinson's a little bit like that. He's got really good north-south acceleration. He's slightly straight-lined, though, but he has good feet as a route runner. He catches. He'll block. He's just not dynamic. And if I'm going to pick a guy high as a running back, he better have some dynamic skill sets that, like I said, it's not only going to keep him on the field for three downs, but he's got to be able to bring something to the table where we're going to have some long runs and we're going to score from way out if we're going to have this guy on the field on third downs.
So you have two guys at number five, Kenneth Walker, Michigan State, Jerrion Ealy, Ole Miss. And Walker's, I've seen him listed one or two in other people's lists. Why five? And if you had a fourth round grade on Brian Robinson, you must have Kenneth Walker lower than that, right?
Yeah, right in the same range. I would have them both in the third round, late third, early fourth. I think the deal with Walker is he was talked about early on as a Heisman candidate, played at Michigan State. I hate to say it, but they get a lot of press, right? People have known about him forever. He's a small guy for me. 5'9", I struggle with him. Yeah, he's 210 pounds, but he's a smallish guy who would rather bounce outside than run inside. He has quickness. He evades people. He's also got speed to turn a corner and run away from people. And that suddenness and bounce laterally make tackles miss him. I like his speed. I just think he's going to be, his vision's a little inconsistent between the tackles and he's a little short so he can hide, but I just don't see him as an every down guy because of that. His running style isn't one that you'd say we can give this guy the ball, 25 times. He kind of reminded me of, I don't know if you remember Javid Best from Cal a couple years back. That's kind of his style for me. He can really make sharp cuts in the secondary once he gets in the secondary. But as a smaller guy, I just didn't think he would be a full-time ball carrier at our league. Kind of reminded me of, like I said, Javid Best, maybe even, a little bit like Clyde Edwards-Helaire. But, his lower body, Helaire, sets him apart, and I didn't see that with Kenneth Walker. The guy I put alongside of him is the Ole Miss kid, and you mentioned it, Jerrion Ealy.
Yeah.
And again, I'm a sucker for this, but when I see a guy that's faster than everybody else and plays faster on tape, I tend to put those guys higher on the list, regardless of how he measures and what he does. And this kid played really fast to me. I think his 40 time was 4.52 or something like that. But when I watch Ole Miss tape, and I watch a lot of it because I was watching Matt Corral as well, this guy seemed like the fastest guy in the field to me. They would give him the ball in one back sets, and he would make people miss. He'd make runs out of nothing. He can catch. He was a hard guy to really bring down. And in his case, he really was sudden and elusive. So I liked him probably a little more than Walker, but I could see either one of these guys being spot players. I think they're both going to struggle, because the best thing they do would be, you'd say, oh, he's a third down back. There's no third down back that can't, that unless he can block. And they're both so small that pass protection is going to be the biggest thing they have to overcome. That really determines how early rookie running backs get on the field, is how they can handle pass protections and how they can hold up against, most of the time, bigger blitzing linebackers. So that's going to be a struggle for those two guys.
Before we hit the tight ends, we mentioned that you drafted Amon Green in Seattle. Was there a story of the drafting him? Was it easy? Did you guys argue? Did somebody want somebody else? Or did it just float with the highest guy on the board and it was straightforward?
No, it was actually piecing together a bunch of stuff, because at Nebraska, and that's where he played, they didn't throw the ball much, and they didn't throw it to backs at all. And we could see the speed. We could see the explosion. It's almost like they ran a little version of the Veer. So he was always running outside, you know, and catching pitches and running around the corner. But we really didn't know if he could catch. And our running back coach at the time, Dennis Erickson was the head coach. But we sent Tim Lapano, our running back coach, to Nebraska.
Remember Tim.
Just to work him out and find out if he could catch. And he passed it. We videoed it. We all came back and said, wow, this guy's no problem catching the ball. In fact, he's got really good hands. But we kind of had to piece it together. But having said that, we got him in the third round. And I, to this day, think he lasted that long because not everybody else had the same confidence level in his ability to catch and run routes as we did. So it ended up, you know, I hate to say this, but I think he's still the leading rusher in the history of the Green Bay Packers, the franchise.
That's unbelievable. Yeah. I think he is too.
I mean, they have a little history there last time I checked. Yeah.
He should have been in Seattle, except a certain coach came in and wanted someone else. That's a different story for another day.
Let me just tell you one thing about that, and this isn't to make fun of anything, but when I went to New Orleans after Amon's first or second year, I think he had been in the league 2 years, and I went to New Orleans as their GM, so I left, obviously, and Mike Holman was the Seahawks coach. And I knew that Mike was kind of lukewarm on him because he used to fumble a little bit. He'd fumble a kickoff
he did early.
There. Yeah. And so, and because Mike always used to complain, hey, can you get him to hang on to the ball? He would make fun
One
of me.
One fumble
because
with
he
a coach
was
like Holmgren, that's it. It's fatal.
Oh, yeah, that was a death
fatal.
Sentence. Yeah, death sentence. Yeah. So when I got there, I kind of had the feeling that he might be on the move at some point. So I remember talking with Mike. And saying, Mike, if you ever decide you want to move this guy, you know, he said, I'll call you. Like 3 weeks later, I read on the internet or something that they trade him to Green Bay as part of, I was physically sick to my stomach when I read that we didn't get him. And guess what? We ended up drafting Deuce McAllister like 3 months later in the draft.
So because but if you would have acquired Amon, you probably don't pick Deuce McAllister, right?
We'd have had no need to pick him. We already had Ricky Williams. People already thought I was crazy enough.
Did Holmgren ever explain why?
Never talked to him about it. No, I never talked to him about it. But I don't know. Maybe it was part of some other deal. You know, obviously he came from Green Bay, so he had relations there, and I understand that. But I was sick to my stomach. Yeah.
Those coach things about a fumble or thing. I remember Holmgren used to tell a story that, like, Bill Walsh never did the shotgun because they used it one time and it was a bad snap. And I'm like, wait a minute, that's going to be enough for you to throw out an entire component of, and it probably wasn't just that simple, but it could be for the coach to just hold on to an hang ball or whatever. So those are our running backs. To recap, Zamir White, James Cook, Breece Hall, Brian Robinson, then a tie, Kenneth Walker, and then the surprise from Ole Miss, Jerrion Ealy.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Hey, Fidelity. What's it cost to invest with the Fidelity app? Start with as little as $1 with no account fees or trade commissions on U.S. stocks and ETFs.
That's music to my ears.
I can only talk.
Investing involves risk, including risk of loss. Zero account fees apply to retail brokerage accounts only. $0 commission applies to online U.S. equity trades and ETFs and retail Fidelity accounts. Sell order assessment fee not included. Some account types and securities excluded. Details at fidelity.com/commissions. Fidelity Brokerage Services LLC, member NYSE SIPC.
Let's get into tight ends. And it's funny, you know, when I first started covering the NFL, tight end was an offensive tackle. They were 280 pounds. You look at guys like Orson Mobley or, you know, big men. And now they're much closer to being a wide receiver. So the game has changed, Randy. When you are looking for a tight end, we talked about two different categories of backs, you know, the every down guy. How do you, there's certainly more than one position of a tight end too, with whether you're a Y tight end or, you know, this, or that. So when you look at the tight ends, just give us a little big picture of what you're looking for. How do you differentiate? Are there even, there probably aren't that many old fashioned tight ends.
No, there's not. And that's a big criteria change from the past, is that we always wanted a guy that could block as well. Nowadays, they're really looking for a big receiver. That's what they're looking for. And it's really become a matchup position. There's still a little disagreement with how to value tight ends in the draft, because they are still tight ends. And are you better off spending it on a receiver that can, you know, play every down and do kind of crazy things for you from long range? Or do you want to get a tight end? And it's hard to argue, because really, tight ends have always been a position where you got to scheme them to get them open. And that's become the criteria for me over the years, is you have tight ends who can get open because of the scheme, and then you have tight ends that can get open because of their athleticism and their feet and ability to separate. So there's two different
categories. Great distinction, because that plays into then how much you can value them. I always wondered that. Like last year, Kyle Pitts went really high, unusually high for a tight end top five.
Yep.
In the back of your mind, if you were, let's say, valuing him, you were going to have a meeting for, geez, do we franchise this guy? How much do we pay him? Is he, or are there tight ends that you would almost pay like a wide receiver, or no?
Yeah, I think there are. I think he's one of them. He could not only get open on his own, he didn't need a schemed offense to be effective. He was open even when he was covered. And there are guys that at the top of their game, you know, Tony Gonzalez, Kelsey, you know, Kittle, those guys are open even when they're covered. I'm probably, you know, overthinking it a little bit, but those kind of guys are valuable. Very few of those guys were top picks either. So they kind of develop into that. But yeah, the criteria is different running attacks, running games. But now here's the problem. Not a problem, but most places now it's about fit. So you might have two or three tight ends. So you may take a certain tight end out on first down, you know, and allow a more bigger, more physical, you know, but that gives away some of your deception as well. So I think the big thing is if your offense can focus and can use a tight end as a focal point, it's probably worth a top pick. If it's not, and that in most of the past teams I've been with, I mean, I was with Antonio Gates. And he was a difference maker, obviously.
Oh, yeah.
But before that, I was really never with a team that had a tight end that was a difference maker. So they were always kind of just plug-in, fill-in guys. So I would have said for the first 20 years in the league, for me, I would have said, no way, we're not going to take a tight end up there. I don't care how good he is. But offenses have changed. You know, it's become a 7-on-7 really game for the most part. So these
and
tight
ends.
And,
you know, apologies. All due respect to Mike Tyson, Christian Fourier. I mean, you know, but yeah.
Mike Tyson, Christian Fourier, and Pete Metzlars, and all those guys would tell you they're blockers first. Trust me.
That's right.
I think group, yeah. Go ahead.
Tyson's a quarterback first, but yes, no, it's another story anyway.
True. Yeah. I would be interested to see, and I didn't really look at a whole bunch of other people's lists when it came to tight ends, because I think the consensus is around the league and around different other platforms that evaluate players is that there is no consensus. I see names jumping all over the place, and that could be because different people value them different people fit them in different with their schemes. You know, I'm going to say that there's a kid that I really liked, and I don't know that I would take any of these tight ends in the first round that I saw. So you're probably starting, and it was like this for years, where your best centers, your best tight ends, they started to fall top of the second round.
Yep.
You know, and that's where I start with this group, is they're probably top of the second round guys. I saw a kid from Coastal Carolina that's 6'4", 245. He ran 4.55 at some point, but is another one where I looked at the tape and I thought, this kid can run well. He separates well. He's a big kid. His name's Isaiah Likely. He's got body control to get in and out of breaks like a little man, but he's a big man.
6'5", 245. Yeah.
He's explosive with his feet under him to separate instantly on inline tight area routes, almost like a receiver.
And yeah. Who's and he remind you of?
Kittle. He reminds me of Kittle. Okay. Yeah, that kind of speed, that kind of. But here's the catch. This kid ran in his pro day. He didn't run at the combine, but he went to his pro day and ran 4.8. Okay. So now what do you do with him, Mike? You've got a really high grade and a good report on him and a good feel from watching film. And your scout or your tight end coach comes back to you and said, this guy ran 4.8. We can't draft this guy. He can't run. What are you going to do? You answer.
I know the Seahawks just held a media combine, and Mike Dugar, who covers the Seahawks for the Athletic, ran a 4.85 at it. So you got to have your tight end that if you're going to draft him, he's got to run faster than the beat guy. I think that's a good rule, don't you?
It is, but that beat guy is not going to show up on tape like this guy did. I promise you.
I'm kidding. I'm kidding.
I know.
Well, what did George Kittle run?
I don't know. That's a good question. I do not know.
You know, I guess at a certain point, something like that can be a deal breaker for you if you're talking about how high you are in the draft. At a certain point, is it as big of a deal?
I had zero question about his speed until I heard someone say he ran 4.8 at his pro day.
Yeah,
zero question. I've watched multiple films on this guy. I've watched all his catches. I had zero question about his speed. He had a 99-yard receiving touchdown in a Division I football game on a little seam route. 99 yards. If he runs 4.8, someone ought to caught him, right? Someone on defense should have caught him.
But you can go test him again and have him run or something, right? Was it a bad day, or is that just...
I got the workout, and I watched it on film, the workout at his school. And I saw a quirky start in that his body moved before his hand moved. He had three or four false starts. And I'm thinking, maybe this guy is just a tough guy to get a good watch on. And again, maybe in my mind, I'm trying to make excuses because I know he's a good player and I want him.
You know, one of the things that I've done with receivers coaches just messing around, you know, you can time how long it takes a guy to get to a certain depth on a route, you know, if it's the same route. And it's really fun to do because what we were doing is we were watching like Michael Irvin and Torrey Holt and these guys running certain routes and seeing how long it takes them to get 19 yards and turn this way or whatever. Mm-hmm. Couldn't you do that type of a thing with Isaiah Likely? He's going to run three different routes, right? 20 times each or 10 times each. Couldn't you time it on the film and just say, oh, you know what? He's right in the way. He's just with everybody else. He's fine. Or no?
You can, yes. And I think that's done regularly. They've split this guy out and he's lined up next to a receiver who's in the slot. So he's a step behind the receiver who's on the line of scrimmage, and at 5 yards, they're even. So that tells me he comes off the ball like he's shot out of a cannon for a big man. You forget how big he is when you watch him run. But for some reason on that day, his time speed was not good. So you got to make a decision.
And we always hear people say, the 40 times overrated, you got to watch the film. Well, here's your extreme test, right, to see if you're willing to do that. But I would have a hard time throwing out the fact that he played football really well and ran for 99 yards in a game and no one caught him.
I agree.
What was Jerry Rice's 40 time or whatever, you know?
It comes down to the decision makers and I think how confident they are in the draft room. Yep. I, too, would say the same thing. I'd say, forget it. I don't care about the speed. Yeah. I know he can run fast. I don't have any doubt. But I know teams that will – you know, won't consider him till round 4 or 5 because they don't want to tie it in their times at 4.8.
Okay, Mueller, then what's your grade? How early would you be okay taking him in a draft, in just a regular draft?
I had him at the top of the second round.
Yeah.
I really did. I think he's a guy that makes all the contested catches. He's got really long arms so he can adjust and catch outside his frame. I just think he's going to be, when he walks off the bus, the quarterback's favorite target. I think he's going to find him. He has some instincts to where he really settles in and out of breaks. He settles in zone spaces, things that are really hard to coach. And not only that, I just think his body control and his athleticism has upside once he gets to the NFL level. I think the details that he learns his first week on the job in the NFL are going to take him to the next level. So you've got to kind of be a little forecaster too of, you know, upside and of skill sets and how good they can be. And I just had a real good feeling about this kid when I saw him. The second guy for me is Trey McBride from Colorado State. Total different style, 6'3 and a half, 246, a quickness, a guy more built like an H-back, maybe a fullback type, catches really confidently, plucks the ball. Not quite. One thing I neglected to say about Likely is that for a big man, he's a really good blocker on the perimeter and second level. He stays after defenders and covers up smaller guys in the running game. So he's not a one-dimensional guy. He can be a really good blocker, especially off the line of scrimmage. I struggled a little bit with McBride in that regard. More of a catcher, will body catch some, but he's a tough kid. They split him out. They do a lot of things with him. I'm trying to think of a comp for him where he can do so many things. He's almost like the big fullback from the Ravens and Kyle Juszczyk from the 49ers, but he's an inch taller, you know? So they could do a lot of things like that with him, in my opinion. He's going to run 4.55 fast enough, but he's not going to run away from people. The reason I ranked him behind Likely is the arm length and the catch radius. Likely catches way away from his body with longer arms. This kid will let it come to him and get inside his frame. And against NFL defenders, they're going to reach around you and knock that ball away if you don't have extended out to catch it. And you can't let him come to your body. Just those catches won't happen.
So does he need to win different types of matchups?
I think in this case, he's a little bit more of a matchup guy at different times based on scheme. I don't have the full confidence that this guy can get open on his own all the time, like I do with Likely. I think this guy can get open, but he's going to need some schemes to help him as well. I felt like he's going to run a route. He is in McBride. He's going to run a route just like it is on the card. In other words, if you write, everybody runs card routes for the defense in practice, he's going to run it exactly like it's coached. But if something comes up, seldom does it ever go like it's on the card, and you got to adjust. I don't know how McBride would do having to adjust things all the time. I just think that the bigger, longer, bigger target Likely would be a better option for you when shit goes south. That's all, if that makes sense.
Yep, absolutely.
So I like McBride the second. The third guy for me was the UCLA guy, Greg Dulcich. 6'4", 243, but he's a one-speed guy. The system kind of has to get him open. He runs 4.7, but he's got some quickness. A little tight as an athlete for me. Good feel versus zones. Little high at his breaking points, but he catches everything. He's going to be a dependable, you know, for me, a third-round type guy, a dependable option at tight end, but never going to be a high-end big playmaker. And I consider these guys, who's the tight end from Cincinnati that just signed with somebody else? He got hurt. Was it like Azuma?
Yeah. He went to the Jets, right?
Yeah. This guy's kind of like him. He's going to have to get schemed open a lot.
Yes. You've got him third then.
Yes.
You've got him third, and then you've got Woods fourth, is that right?
Yeah, and I think I only looked at four of them, to be honest. Yeah. I looked at a bunch, but I only came back with four. Jelani Woods was intriguing to me because you're talking about a 6'7", 255-pound basketball player-looking dude now. You talk about long. He is a runs 4.6. He's kind of a one-speed, longer, striding guy, but all of a sudden he's on you and by you. I think he's going to be a nightmare on third downs and in the red zone. He's got good body control. He can get in and out of his breaks at times. I just don't know that there's a big body of work with him. I don't think football is been in his background his whole life. So he probably has more upside because of it, but he's going to have to learn a little bit about playing the position still. But that big target and hands that are adequate, again, Philip Rivers would take all these guys he can get. Philip's a big guy at 6'5". He said, I want to throw to other big guys. So 6'5 to 6'7, that's something that some quarterbacks, you know, really, they don't have to look for them when there's traffic, and there's always traffic over the middle. These guys kind of open themselves up. And again, like the guys we talked about before, they catch when they're covered and they're open when they're covered. So they're still going to have to make, you know, catches, and the ball's still going to be, they're going to be targeted even when they're, when they are covered. Yep. So I like those guys for the most part. I wouldn't say that any of them are game breaking type difference makers. I think likely can be at some point, but that's a shot in the dark too, because there's, you know, there's that speed thing that I don't see on tape, but I see in the workouts. So I don't know what you think of that group.
And you mentioned a little bit of a Kittle comp. Now, Kittle mauls people in the run game too. Were you talking mostly just as a receiver, or do you see
for similarities?
Yeah, for Likely. You'd mentioned him.
I think Likely is going to be a really good inline blocker. I think he could become Kittle. He's already a really good perimeter blocker and a second level blocker, because he's willing, he's competitive, he's tough. They just don't use him as that. So at Coastal Carolina, so there's a leap of faith there.
Yeah, no, it's a good group. It's a good group.
Yeah,
it's indicative that we're going to do a top five tight ends, and we came up with four. That's sort of how it is, and that's what you're
for
talking
this year.
About. You could stretch it out to 10, but let's not imply that there's 10, right?
Right, I agree.
So. Okay, before we wrap up here, let's hit the big news of the week, as everyone's in their draft rooms, was really in the courtroom with Brian Flores, former Dolphins head coach, has amended his lawsuit against the NFL. And we want to talk about this because it's hiring. This is interesting stuff, and clearly the processes need to improve. But he has amended his lawsuit against the NFL, and his efforts have been joined by Steve Wilks and Ray Horton with some new and specific allegations. The coaches are basically alleging violations of federal and state civil rights statutes. My old friend from ESPN, Kevin Seifert, pointed out they can ultimately try to prove one of two things. And we're not going to dwell too much on the legal because we're not lawyers, but they can try to prove disparate treatment, which requires proof of intentional discrimination, or they can try to prove disparate impact, which requires proof that a policy impacts minorities differently than it applies to others. Now, like I said, not an attorney. I don't know the legal strategies, but I think I do want to discuss, Randy, especially since you've been in the GM chair where you hire coaches or are involved in hiring coaches. I do want to talk about minority hiring in the NFL, separate from just hiring in general, especially as we've seen recently where there's been not only these types of allegations, but a time where there's only one or two black coaches in the league at a time, and it's gotten a lot of attention. And really, for me, the question is whether the teams take the minority hiring seriously enough to legitimately prioritize it in the hiring process through the Rooney Rule, or if that rule is, which we've seen at times, just a box that has to be checked and procedurally you need to interview X number of people and then we can really go do what we were going to do anyway. And so I want to set aside some aspects of this lawsuit that I find distracting from that, and that is whether Steve Wilks was a bridge coach, whether he wanted Josh Allen instead of Josh Rosen, whether the GM was doing his job. To me, those are all things that, as you know, anyone could face. I mean, you've negotiated contracts from an elementary school parking lot two states away from the team facility because your owner was trying to move the team. A lot of these jobs have things in them that make it hard. I think we need to focus on the hiring process itself.
Yep.
And the thing that was interesting to me that was different than what I've seen before in these types of things is that audio recording of Mike Mularkey, which I never saw that from 2020. But all of a sudden it comes out, and Mike Mularkey basically says this. He was hired by the Titans in 2016. He had been the interim coach there, and they had fired Ken Wisenhunt, and then they made him the head coach. And he basically said this: I allowed myself at one point when I was in Tennessee to get caught up in something I regret. I still regret it. The ownership there, Amy Adams Strunk and her family, came in and told me I was going to be the head coach in 2016 before they went through the Rooney Rule. And so I sat there knowing I was the head coach, and they went through this fake process, knowing a lot of the coaches. He said, I knew a lot of the coaches they were interviewing, know how much they prepared, knowing everything they could do, they had no chance to get the job. He's the GM there, John Robinson. He was in the interview with me. He had no idea why he's even interviewing me because I had the job already. He basically said he regretted it. To me, Randy, this is the reason I say this is different is we just never had that type of specifics about a specific hire. We don't really get behind the curtain in that specific way. What I wanted to ask you was, I think in these hiring processes, We know that human nature is to fall in love with a candidate. Even sometimes when you fire a candidate, you probably have a list of some people that you might want to hire. And while that can create a comfortable fit or a good fit, it can also exclude a lot of people and really run roughshod over the Rooney Rule and the process to get the best coach. And I wanted to ask you, like, what, as you kind of look at this, and I think we have transitioned to now where there's more attention on the hiring and whether they're following the rules because they have to or because it's in their heart. What are some things that could be done to improve that process and make sure it's not kind of what Malarkey described?
Right. Well, a couple of things come to my mind. I've always said that we need to spend more effort and energy on the process before it ever gets to the Rooney Rule box. In other words, I always think it's about relationships. And we talked about it, I think, on the podcast earlier this year, where I would love to see the league go back and come up with some kind of, not only process, but some kind of a program where you can hook up potential, especially minority coaches, with GMs, with ownership. And everybody says, oh, they've done that for years. Well, they've done it in a formal setting at some fancy resort. I'm talking about informally around a campfire or playing golf or fishing or something crazy like that, where you can actually build relationships, right? And not be encumbered by the boss always being there. So I've always thought we've done a bad job of really just culturing relationships. So that's one thing. The other thing is, teams now have a director of inclusion and diversity. Every team has one. They all did it a year or two ago and have that person on staff. You probably should include them in this process just for the sake of getting the process to be a disciplined and structured format. And if we are to believe, and I know Mike Malarkey personally, he's a man of his integrity. I don't doubt anything he said, but now this has come to light. This clearly was a fact that they had hired a guy before they even went through the process. You just can't have that. So that's got to be, you know, addressed, whether it ends up being part of a lawsuit or not. I don't know. That's way above my pay grade. But you just can't have this type of thinking if we're going to make progress. So I think from the standpoint of the Rooney Rule, maybe we've outlived it a little bit. I wish they'd push it back to where they'd start this relationship culturing earlier. But at the same time, we have people in place in offices now in the NFL.
That's just a new thing too in the last couple
of
years.
It is a new thing. Yeah, just come in the last year or two, that this ought to be able to help the process, help and make sure that we don't say things like this, that you don't allow decisions to get made without the process having been thorough and for the process to actually go through like the calendar says it should. So I think there are a couple things in place. We've just got to make an effort to institute them and then follow them and police them.
And I think one of the things that's really helpful is knowing who's on the search committees and all of that, and having that be above board and public. And I think a director of diversity and inclusion is going to, of course, have that. But it's been very helpful to know. You can almost predict who's going to get hired sometimes, or who's not going to get hired, when you see who it is that's on those committees. And we talked about the Minnesota one, you know, where there were people from the previous personnel staff on it, the salary cap person's on it. There's all these different people who just through human nature are going to want, they're going to want to not want certain people to be hired. And I think the more that we can know about that, the more that we can then analyze it, the more we can ask questions about it, the more it can just be known, then we can have a better feel for why certain people are hired, and we can evaluate it and criticize it when it needs to be criticized, as opposed to the mystery black box here where, I don't know why they hired this guy. I guess he knew this person, right? That sort of thing.
Yeah. You've got to find a way, and I'm not sure I have the answer for it, but you've got to find a way to make the process pure. It has to be pure. It has to be reasonable, and it has to be non-agenda affected. And you said it. There's a lot of these hiring processes that I can tell even from just the people already in the building what kind of person is going to get the job, just because of the kingdoms and the walls and the fences that are built in certain organizations. And so you're not going to hire a certain type of person or maybe a certain knowledge level of person because there are people trying to protect their own backside. But a lot of that comes from ownership. And I've been involved in several of these hires of coaches. And I will say this, in every one of the ones I was involved in, I feared the owner. I feared the boss. So I wanted this to be a legitimate search, and it had to be backed up by a solid, disciplined process and gather the information like you would having no idea who you're going to hire, whether you had a hunch in the back of your head or not. But I just think that is between the GM and the head coach. I mean, the GM and the owner. And you've got to have that respect factor, and that owner's got to lean on you because they are the leader of this process at the end of the day. Nobody's getting hired without their stamp. So I just think that's where it kind of falls, and it falls on owners and leaders and GMs to make sure the process is pure and don't let the agendas of other people in the building even get involved.
And the owners are sensitive to criticism. We always wonder what can influence an owner. Well, they do read. Oh, no. They do
and
care
listen to the radio
perceived.
And
listen
yeah,
to all
yeah,
that stuff. Yeah. They really do. So I think the more that we can analyze these processes too and criticize them when they need to be criticized or point out situations of what are you doing is helpful. But clearly there has to be processes within the building yep. to make sure that doesn't happen. And I think actually this coming out is a positive thing on that Tennessee situation because of the awareness and because of the focus it puts on the process. And I feel like we're getting more and more focus and process and light being shined on these hires every year. And to me,
it just can't be tainted.
Really
this shows an example of a process that was tainted, and it just can't be that way. It should never be that way. But
absolutely, and we'll see what comes of it.
Yeah.
At a league level, the league basically wasn't aware of this interview with Malarkey either, and we'll see what comes out the rest of this lawsuit with the Brian Flores situation. And maybe there is more. He certainly said some things about Stephen Ross of the Dolphins, so we will see that. We are about out of time. Randy, I didn't have much else on my list today, even though it's been a busy free agency period. I think we've gotten to most things. Was there
I think we did. Hopefully we haven't bored our listeners to death with the breakdown of the running backs and tight ends, but it is the time of year when these draft lists and criterias and critiques are a newsworthy item, I think, for the most part.
Yep, and next week we'll do another position. Do you have in the back of your mind what you want to do next week? We can tease.
No, I haven't got that far yet. At some point, we're going to have to talk about the quarterbacks, though. And
we sure
I have
are.
Already done all that, all the film on that, so we could make it.
Let's do the quarterbacks next week.
Yeah,
let's do the quarterbacks next week. I think that'll be of great interest, and appreciate your work on that. Appreciate everybody listening in. I'm Mike Sando, senior writer from The Athletic. You can find me on Twitter at SandoNFL. You can find Randy Mueller not only on Twitter at @RandyMueller_. You can find him at MuellerFootball.com. Thanks, everyone.
This was The Athletic Football Show.
Hey, football fans, this is Diana Rossini from The Athletic. Get the top stories in pro football snapped directly to your inbox with our latest NFL newsletter, Scoop City. Jacob Robinson and I will bring you the daily scoop of top NFL articles, posts, and podcasts every Monday to Friday. Sign up for free now at theathletic.com/scoop.